storms never last, do they, baby? Bad times all pass with the wind.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly cable program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is James Anderson, author of the mystery novel, The Never Open Desert Diner. James is a native of the Pacific Northwest, born in Seattle, raised in Portland, and a graduate of Reed College. He founded Brighton Bush Books, a publishing company based in Portland, and ran it from 1976 to 1991. In addition to writing and publishing, James has worked as a logger, commercial fisherman, car salesman, and truck driver. James was a guest on Between the Covers in June of last year when The Never Open Desert Diner, which is his first novel, was published by Caravelle Books, a small press in New York. Since that time, the book was picked up by Crown Publishers, which is a division of Penguin Random House and a very big press in New York. The second edition was revised by the author and published in March of this year, and the book just came out in paperback in November. James joins us in the KBOO studios today to talk about his novel and the story behind the book's amazing success and rebirth. James Anderson, thanks very much for being here once again on Between the Covers.
It's always a pleasure, Ken. Thank you.
Yeah, usually authors never come back. I don't know what it is. It could be me. But your book, The Never Open Desert Diner, takes place in the Utah desert, but you were born, raised, and educated here in the Pacific Northwest. Can you tell us a little about that part of your life?
Well, yeah, I can, as a matter of fact. I was born in Seattle and then raised in the Willamette Valley and over on the Oregon coast. And it was a peripatetic existence. My sister and I were raised by a single divorced mother, and we moved around a lot as she found work. And so my childhood memories are primarily of the Pacific Northwest, coming into the studio, coming through the rain. There's a peculiar darkness here in the Pacific Northwest that comes with the rain. Actually kind of like it. It made me nostalgic.
Kind of the opposite of the desert, which we'll get into later.
It is.
As mentioned in the intro, you're not only a writer, but a very experienced publisher, and you ran Brighton Bush Books for 15 years and actually started it while you were senior at Reed College here in Portland. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to start your own publishing company, and what were the challenges, especially for a college undergraduate?
Well, you know, it was my senior year at Reed, so I was doing my thesis as well, and we got a $500 grant. My feeling then, as now, is that there are a lot of amazing writers out there, and I wanted to showcase some of them. And Mark Twain has a great quote about what you need to be a publisher: ignorance and arrogance and money. I didn't have any money, but I was well supplied in the ignorance and the arrogance. I had not a clue what it took to be a publisher. So I did this little book called The Oregon Anthology of College Poetry. And then from there, the next book was Peter Sears, who just wound up his 2-year stint as poet laureate. We did Mary Barnard, Clyde Rice, Naomi Shihab Nye. So it was on the job training. The first book I did, I did not know that bookstores got a discount. It was sort of like, oh my God. For every book we sold, I think I lost $3.
So. Did you go down to Walter Powell
Books and
try to sell him the book for the cover price?
You know, I knew Walter wasn't going to take it. Deborah Roboy, who was really sweet, who ran the Catbird Seat bookstore for years, did. But I, as you know, I spent a lot of time in Walter's store before Powell's Books and Michael came back to town and took it all over. Spent a lot of time on Walter Powell's floor going through books.
I wanted to get to the book itself, which is really the kind of the subject of the interview. Mm-hmm. The Never Open Desert Diner is your first published novel, and you're now 64 as of this year?
I'm going to be 65 real quick here in March.
Well, yeah. So the question is, and you've been asked this a lot about that kind of long wait to publish a novel, and I love this answer that you gave, and I quote, "There comes a time when if you've always been planning on doing something, you better get to it."
Well, true.
But you also said, and I think this was the last time we talked, you started the book pretty much as a way to pass the time while helping a friend kick a heroin habit.
Well, that's true. I invited a friend into my home, and there's a novel that I still hope will come out one day, about 450 pages of it, and heroin addicts, he stole everything out of my house. He stole my computer, hard drive.
Which had the manuscript
which
on
had,
it.
Yeah. And so then we started traveling around while he was coming off of heroin withdrawal, and I started writing Never Open Desert Diner as a way to sort of entertain myself.
With the pen and paper then? Because your computer was gone?
Oh, gee, it was on envelopes and stationery and whatever I could find to write on it as we were moving around the Southwest.
The book, after you started going and getting some momentum on it, the book became much more than a way to pass the time. You wrote the first draft in 6 months, but then spent 2 years completing 14 major revisions.
Mm-hmm.
There must have been a point when it became a serious obsession, when you got to thinking that the book was something you wanted to complete and get out to the world.
Every obsession is serious. I wrote 6 or 7 novels before this one. I never really tried to publish any of them. Sometimes writers, you'll hear people say, well, I write just for myself. Well, you have no idea how true that is. I wanted to entertain myself, and when I write, some people write from an outline. I just write straight through.
Even this book, a mystery, which you'd figure would need more complex plotting in advance.
Yes, but see, here's what happens. You write it straight through, and then you see what you have. It's sort of like a sculptor rolling the big piece of marble out. So you have this big piece of marble. You have to get that rock in front of you, and then you begin to sort of chip away at it and go, oh, well, you know, here's an arm, here's a leg, here's a, you know, and then you begin working on it, and eventually you get down to the fine work and the polishing and so on. But you have to get this sort of monolithic rough draft out. There's a saying out there, rough drafts don't need to be perfect, they just need to be written. And I know people who have been working 20 years on
that first
a novel.
Draft.
Yeah. No, get it all out there. And for me, the rough draft is some of the most fun because you get to do anything you want. I mean, you know, there's the editorial voice, but there are parts in this book that wouldn't have been there if I would have tried to outline it. You know, I'm thinking about the bathroom scene.
Oh.
You know, that scene came about because I realized I'd written my character into a bathroom, and now what was I going to do? So something had to happen.
Oh, that's the diner bathroom?
Okay. Well, in the...
And obviously we're talking around that.
Right, because that's a big moment.
Yes, yeah, revelation there in the book.
Yeah, if you'll excuse me, that was a big moment, yeah.
So you finished the book 6 months again for the draft, 14 revisions later and 2 years later, and start sending it out for publication. I read it's rejected by 20 agents, numerous publishing companies, but fortunately it just takes one, and Caravelle Books in New York says yes. They're a small press, but they did a great job on the book. I've got it here, the earlier edition, and that's the copy I received for our first interview.
Mm-hmm.
How did the book go from there to getting picked up by Crown?
It really is amazing. I mean, I have very small hopes. For me, Michael Chabon just came out with a new book.
Moonglow, right?
Oh, yeah, and I love his work. And he said a few years ago, if you're not in love with a blank page, go do something else, because you don't have any control over whether it gets published, whether it gets reviewed, whether it wins any awards. No. You better be in love with a blank page. That's the real reward. Since nobody really liked the book, and that's a... Not only did some not like the book, they were very candid about not liking it.
Oh, but there were a lot of glowing reviews, James. But when I prepared for that first interview, that you had New York Times.
But see, what happened was is that the book went out for review, and reviewers, it's not uncommon for reviewers to receive 5,000 books in a week. And so I New York Times and Huffington Post and later Washington Post, Book World, Chicago. There were just so many of them. Even after the New York Times Book Review came out, agents still didn't even want to see the book. And of those that did see it, said, "Oh no." And quite by accident, an agent who buys books at Otto Penzler's store in New York, I think this is the way it went. He asked the manager, "So what are you reading? You know, anything interesting?" And he goes, "Yeah, you know, there's this, you know, it's kind of strange." And he goes, "Well, here, I'll buy a copy." Well, he took it with him to go out of town over the weekend. And on Monday, he called me and said, "Gee, I know I'm late to the party, but would you need an agent?" And so at that point, he started showing it to larger publishers. And Crown had great enthusiasm for it. And so I ended up signing a multi-book deal with Crown. So I did some revisions for Crown.
I was going to ask about that. You worked with an editor at Crown.
Right.
What kind of revisions did they request?
Well,
you didn't change the plot, obviously.
No,
I've read it twice now.
Actually, I didn't change a whole lot. But one of the things that happens is, over a period of time, there are so many people in your kitchen, in your literary kitchen, that novels are so organic. If you change something on page 21... it changes something on page 67, page 113, you know, it just all the way down the line. Well, in that process, the first time around, for instance, that novel, Never Open Desert Diner, takes place over a three-week period. Well, as the production person at Crown said, "You know, I don't know how things are in the desert, but you've got a full moon for 3 weeks."
Oh, okay, and you fixed that.
Yeah, so,
but that was in the first edition, and I didn't pick up on that.
Well, and so there were a lot of things mm-hmm. like that, just little things. And then another thing that happened was there was a day missing. Just, and so I went back and kind of filled that day. It was a good experience. I mean, the people at Crown were. And still are tremendous.
I think in movies that's called continuity. Yeah,
continuity.
Where there's a scene where somebody's wearing one article of clothing, and then it's supposed to happen the next minute, but they've already changed. And
yes,
or there's a mic that appears and it shouldn't. So
there were a lot of things, but basically they loved the book, and there were just a few things, the missing day, and so on. So I don't think overall there were more than 500 or 1,000 changes, you know, in the book.
That seems like a lot, but you're talking about very small changes.
I'm talking about, like, typos, errata,
right.
And so on.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with James Anderson, author of the mystery novel The Never Open Desert Diner, which is now out in paperback. And, of course, all the publishing success of The Never Open Desert Diner comes from the fact it's a very entertaining and moving story with strong characters that the reader gets to know mm-hmm. and care about. The novel can be described as a noirish mystery, reminiscent of writers like Raymond Chandler, Ross McDonald, James Crumley. You dedicate the book, actually, to these authors and a few others. I also felt the spirit of several Humphrey Bogart movies in there, like High Sierra, even a bit of Treasure of Sierra Madre
sure.
towards the end.
Yeah, I've heard
again,
that.
Again, not giving too much away. Who and what were your actual influences on the book? Were they mostly mystery writers?
No. I mean, Thomas Merton was a huge
More
influence.
More of a spiritual writer.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I love the great mystery writers. And it always seemed to me that the plot wasn't really all that important. Because if you don't care about the characters, who cares? I mean, oh, well, you know, Miss Detweiler, you know, tripped over a body. You know, who cares? I mean, really. So I didn't really sit down to write a mystery. I sat down to create a world and to create characters that I was engaged with. And in the process of doing that, you develop questions that become mysteries. Why is there this diner out in the middle of the desert that is kept in pristine shape but is never open?
And so you had kind of an image of that diner in your mind, and then there were all these questions that arose.
Well,
how
you know,
did it get there?
That kind of diner is not only iconic, it's archetypal. I'm thinking about even films like, you know, Tremors and so on. There's a diner kind of grocery store, gas station out in the middle of nowhere, and bad stuff happens there, right? You know, and in this case, the bad stuff happened 40 years earlier, and now we have a truck driver who is friends with the owner, and little by little, that tragedy from 40 years earlier begins to permeate Ben's life and Walt Butterfield, the owner. So that's the other thing about crimes too. There's never just one victim to a crime, and it isn't over. It goes on and on and on. The suffering goes on, in this case, over four decades.
Let's talk first about the main character who you mentioned, Ben Jones, and he actually has a fairly unique background for the mystery genre. He's a truck driver on this barren desert highway in Utah, this fictional Highway 117. And the probability is that he's not quite sure, but the probability is that he's the son of a Jewish social worker and a Native American male, and he doesn't know his mother or his father. He was given up at birth and later adopted by this older white couple. How did you come up with Ben? Again, an extremely unique character for a mystery, for a noir.
I can't go back to my thought processes at the time, except that Ben... You look at oppressed people, and to have somebody who is both Native American and Jewish and an orphan in the desert.
That's like four strikes, huh?
You know, yeah. You know, as an aside, I don't know, you might want to cut this out, but I got a fan letter signed by somebody who said ex-fan. Because this person was so upset because I'm not a Donald Trump supporter. And this person was so upset, they said, oh, well, you know, Ben Jones would have certainly been a Trump supporter. And I thought, wait a minute. Native American, Jewish, orphan. Now, Ben is against all kinds of things that would take him out of the running for being a Trump supporter.
The book was also written pre-Trump. It's funny you mentioned that because I was thinking about that, but politics, the place is so isolated, and the people, most of the characters just want to be left alone. Politics doesn't enter into it.
No.
Which seemed perfect for Utah when you think of it. I mean, I was reading that most people there couldn't vote for Trump either. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to vote for Hillary. They were going to vote for this one independent.
Right.
So the politics there are not quite as cut and dried, I think, as your ex-reader.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that you're out in this 100-mile stretch of desert. There's no cell phone reception, so Ben doesn't carry a cell phone. And I wanted as much emphasis as possible to fall on the characters in a natural landscape trying to survive. No, politics really doesn't enter into it, except that they refuse to accept mail. They won't use the U.S. postal system, and it's a hard life. Mm-hmm. It's a hard life. But they're willing to accept that harshness because of the natural beauty and just the love of the solitude.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that. Ben, as a character, he's just scraping by mm-hmm. as an independent driver in the book, and actually he's about to go bankrupt. He's way behind in payments on his truck. It's going to be foreclosed probably within a week.
Yeah.
The other characters he interacts with, for the most part, are in similar situations. They're not exactly the Koch brothers
no.
in the book. And you've said, and I quote, "I believe noir literature really is the literature of the oppressed and the marginalized, because you're fighting for a little light for someone in a dark world." I was wondering, is that one reason you're attracted to that genre, the noir mystery?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it is. If you go back, you look at Lou Archer, any of the characters in true noir, mm-hmm. Back into Chandler and so on, yeah, they talk a lot about, no, I'm going to mind my own business, I'm going to do this and do that, and then they risk everything to help someone. Often they end up helping people along the way in the process. So it's very much about taking care of other people in the world, even if you don't like them. Even if they've been mean to you, or even if they don't pay their bills.
Mm-hmm. And Ben actually has this very odd friendship, very strong friendship with Walt Butterfield, who's the 79-year-old
who's
owner.
Probably the only guy that actually does pay his bill, but, you know. Yeah.
Yes, but Walt is not that courteous or gentle with Ben, and there's some scenes in there that exhibit that.
It's true.
And yet there's a strong friendship there.
It's true. There's a gruffness. You know, it's one of the most wonderful things is to receive so much correspondence from people, and I have a line in there about conversation is parceled out like water in the desert, very sparingly, and there isn't usually a lot of conversation that goes on. And with Walt, he's just an old hard ass. Can I say hard ass?
I think so. I'll beep it if not.
But on the other hand, you know, Lee Marvin makes a kind of an appearance in this book.
Yes, that's an odd choice, and yet it describes Walt. Walt's best friend is Lee Marvin. They were in the Marines together.
In Korea. Mm-hmm. And what a lot of people don't realize is Lee Marvin played, you know, this sort of tough guy. You'd think that he was, to use the word nowadays, you know, really conservative. Lee Marvin was an absolute liberal. He was involved in so many liberal causes, and he hated war. He was college educated and decorated Korean War vet.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I know he was in a lot of war movies.
Yeah, so you know he was sort of cast as this sort of bad guy and so on, but the person of Lee Marvin is really quite different than what people would think. And that was Walt's best friend. They were Marines in Korea together. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure. That's that rough draft. I'm going.
So Lee Marvin kind of crept into the rough draft, and
well,
you'd figure, oh, that's kind of a happy.
Well,
accident
yes,
there.
Because I'm building that backstory for Walt, and part of it is that the diner gets. In the early years, gets used as a movie set for like B horror films.
Yeah, you said you know? Quite a few. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and Walt and Lee Marvin were friends. So Lee Marvin actually never makes an appearance, but he becomes a character that Ben knows about, and then
yeah,
Walt,
he does appear in a photograph, I guess, with Walt.
That's right.
and with Walt's former
and
wife.
And again, in the famous bathroom scene,
which we can't talk anymore about. People have to read the book for that. There's a reading group guide on your website, and this is the last of this suggested questions for the reading
hell,
group.
Yes.
Okay,
I've never read that, but go ahead.
Okay. Oh, so you didn't come up with the questions? But
I might have. Yeah.
Okay, the last one is, and I quote: "In the final chapter, John the preacher tells Ben that he's spending too much time alone. What do you think the future holds for Ben? Do you think he will find love again?" Now, I've heard rumors, James, that you recently submitted the manuscript for your second Ben Jones novel, mm-hmm. to Crown. Mm-hmm. Can you give our listeners a little preview of what the future holds for Ben? Will he find love again? And maybe when that book will become available for Ben Jones fans.
Well, the book is already, it's been there since September, and it's already accepted. It's going to be out in Lullaby Road. It's going to be out in late 2017, maybe early 2018. Mm-hmm. And Ben is, he fell in love with Claire, and Claire's not around anymore. Let's just say that. He's not the kind of guy that's going to, he's not one of these detectives that just sort of, you know, sleeps around or whoever. He was in love. So in the new book, he doesn't fall in love, but there is another woman, and he ends up trying to protect her.
Will there be some recurring characters?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Jenny comes back, and John, who hauls that,
who's the preacher.
itinerant preacher who hauls this cross up and down a desert road, is actually a victim of a hit and run. Mm. So it's a continuation. You know, Crown was interested in having me turn this into a series character. I said I would do three books. I've planned a trilogy. I prefer to think of it as a triptych because I see it more as a landscape, an expanse, rather than, you know, separate. So they'll be standalone, but they'll all be connected. But there's only going to be three of them.
Have you started work on that third one yet, or you still got the second one, revisions?
I'm actually working on a memoir now, but I'm making notes for the third one. So the answer to that is that things get a little tougher and a little darker for Ben in the desert, and for the people he knows in the desert, but they manage to take care of each other through very difficult times.
Well, James, thanks very much for coming to KBOO.
It's terrific.
And especially talking with you again. Great pleasure for me.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
We've been talking with James Anderson, author of the mystery novel, The Never Open Desert Diner, which you can now find in paperback in addition to hardcover, digital, and audio editions. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to James for visiting us again at KBOO, and to all of you for listening.
How can we help you, Utah? How can we make you great? Well, we got skills in our desert, and we got to get some things to grow, and we got to tell this country about Utah, 'cause nobody else seems to know. Da 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 da